goings on at the imperial court. They time their attacks, generally when the Eastern Army is preoccupied elsewhere, and the main military forces are in Africa fighting Vandals or tied up on the Eastern frontier. And this is another aspect about these great nomadic confederations put together by charismatic leaders. They create tent capitals, these great cities that attract craftsmen and specialists, all sorts of trade. And Attila had more knowledge, probably, of the overall geographic dimensions of the Roman world, where to attack, when to attack, and his position, his knowledge near the Roman Empire allowed him to frame really rather sophisticated strategies. And this bears comparison to Genghis Khan and his grandsons, who would wage great campaigns and probably had the best geographic knowledge in the world during the 13th century. And this is a function of a nomadic society engaged in long-distance travel, knowledge of the wider steppes, as well as attracting all of these people to the great court of Attila, who ruled essentially, the term is anachronistic, essentially like a great Khan, the way the Mongol Khans would rule. So Attila had a powerful vision of what he can do, where he could attack into the Eastern Roman Empire, why he was had these arrangements with the Western Roman Empire. Now the victories netted plunder, captives, above all, gold. These were the ingredients that sustained the Hun Empire. And one could argue, to some extent, Attila never envisioned a methodical conquest of the Roman Empire any more than the Xuang Nu did. For one, the numbers were against you. In both cases, the Xuang Nu in the 2nd century BC, Attila in the 5th century AD, the most that Attila could count among all of his subjects, including the German tribes of Central Europe, who are now vassals, the grasslands of Eastern Europe, the tribes on the Pontic-Caspian steppes, maybe a million subjects, 800,000. The adult men, however, were all warriors, and particularly those horse archers were ready to go. The Xuang Nu probably had a similar number, maybe a million. The same was true of the Eastern steppes under the Mongols. The great sedentary empires, the Roman Empire, the Han Empire, were there, you're looking at empires running somewhere between 55 and 65 million people. And this disparity is a determining factor in the strategies of Attila, as well as later steppe conquerors, particularly the Mongols, but even lesser conquerors of northern China. So his objective was to wrest control of certain crucial border areas, to break down the barriers on the Danube to allow him easy access into the Roman provinces so he could plunder and gain gold and captives and reward all of his vassal rulers and sustain his position. That was important. That is to make sure that that Roman frontier stretching along the Danube was no longer a frontier, but now was a highway that would allow the movement of Hun forces on their road looking for goodies. This is clearly the thrust between a treaty that we have in detail signed in 447, negotiated by the Roman envoy Anatolus, who was then the master of the Eastern Roman army, and a representative of Theodosius. That was a treaty that not only promised a very heavy tribute. The previous tribute paid to the Huns was more like a subsidy of 700 pounds of gold. The treaty triples it to 2,100 pounds. Arrears are made up. There's other arrangements. But the real key is that the Roman frontier along the Danube is now essentially dismantled. And the Romans are not to approach the Danube from the south or from the west from a distance of something like 5 days, which is, by Hun standards, traveling on horses, you're looking anywhere from 100 to 200 miles, depending on what they would want to claim. So one objective was to make sure that the that frontier zone was now in securely in Hun hands. The other important point was to exploit tribute, to exploit a system that his ancestors would have been familiar with the Chinese emperors, the Han emperors. That is, at some point, Attila would be recognized as the great leader of a confederation, and from that would come some kind of imperial marriage, some kind of recognition, some sort of sense of equality, if and in the case of the Eastern Roman Emperor, actually subordination to this great conqueror. In 444 or 445, Attila had a falling out with his older brother. We're not sure what it was. The sources give some colorful anecdotes. Bleda is presented as a brother with an incredibly acid and even a nasty wit. He took to using a dwarf, a Roman dwarf from Mauritania, I think, who had been captured in a raid as a way of criticizing Attila at court, embarrassing his brother. There was a horrible falling out. There's always this problem within these nomadic confederations when there's two brothers. Eventually, one brother is more charismatic, more successful than the other, and invariably it leads to either a civil war, a parting of the ways, or one brother doing in the other. And Attila did in Bleda in a hunting accident somewhere around 445. From that point on, apparently Attila is the unquestioned ruler of the various Hun tribes in a great confederation that essentially is a barbarian counter-empire to the Roman world. He had no restraints at this point. He waged war ruthlessly in the Eastern Roman Empire. He extorted that treaty in 447, which essentially gave him access to the Balkan provinces of the Roman world. He destroyed that imperial frontier. Theodosius II and his government had to consent to annual payments of 2,100 pounds of gold. Now, I have calculated what this might represent in real buying power to the Roman emperor. It probably was cheaper than trying to fight the Hun armies. Clearly, later Hun emperors discovered the same. It was cheaper to buy the Xuannu as allies than to wage a direct war, which is what Wu Di did, starting with his great campaigns in the 130s and 120s BC. But it was humiliating. Attila loved calling Theodosius his slave in all of these exchanges. And furthermore, the Roman cities in the European provinces really existed on the sufferance of Attila. He had the hordes of horse archers, numerous other barbarian allies, an engineering corps that could capture cities, and should he be moved, he could capture and sack any of these cities at will to demonstrate his power. Furthermore, the emperor behind those powerful walls, those powerful Theodosian walls, all of a sudden felt very vulnerable when those walls were badly damaged in an earthquake in 447, and the entire population of the city was put to work to repair those walls and have them up and running in early 448 because they feared a Hun attack. And that is how successful Attila was vis-a-vis the Eastern Roman government. Now, in 450 AD, Attila was at the height of his power. He commanded a confederation and a number of nomadic warriors, clearly on the order of the Xuannu Confederation under Modu Chanyu. And those two confederations are comparable in a number of ways. It is at this point that a peculiar circumstance, doubted by some scholars, but I suspect it's true, I really believe it's true, in fact, resulted in Attila dramatically changing his policy by invading the Western Empire, which hitherto had been his ally. This gets us a bit into Roman, lurid Roman politics of the court of Ravenna, where the Western emperors have resided since 402 AD, and also to some aspects of Roman law and the nomadic customs and expectations that Attila believed in. First, in 450 AD, Attila received a ring and apparently what he took as a marriage proposal from the Empress Honoria. Honoria was the elder half-sister of the then reigning Western Emperor Valentinian III, an incredibly weak and ineffectual emperor, dominated by his mother and, of course, his master of the soldiers, Aetius. And his mother and his warlord, Generalissimo, both hated each other. Honoria likewise resented her brother. She felt that she had a better claim to the throne, and therefore anyone she married would have a better claim to the throne than her half-brother. She was caught in a number of plots and intrigues. There were a number of scandalous stories. She'd been playing around with the chief chamberlain. That didn't look good. And finally, Valentinian and Aetius decided the only way to neutralize her was to marry her to a very elderly and very boring senator. And apparently Honoria got it in her head to send this ring and message to Attila. And this would have been known since Attila was in regular communication with the Western court, and essentially said, save me. Furthermore, one speculates whether this rather bored late Roman empress, cloistered in the palace and hearing all these wild stories about Hun barbarians and the kind of savage men they were, had all sorts of exciting ideas of what this new husband would be like. Certainly a far better option to her than the elderly senator that her half-brother had lined up for. In any case, Attila got the message and the ring. In my opinion, Attila thought, it's come. The final marriage offer, the imperial family now recognizes me as the greatest lord in the world. Shuang Nu rulers, Chan Yu, would expect a Chinese imperial bride, silks, a whole retinue of members coming from the Chinese court to indicate that you were now a great ally and really in many ways on par with the Son of Heaven himself. This is what Attila expected that message was. And so he sent back saying, yes, and by the way, I would like to take control of Gaul and Spain, which are the dowry of my wife-to-be. Well, this was unacceptable to Roman emperors. They still operated on the law under the laws of a republic. First, the empress should not have married without her brother's permission. And second, by the way, she's a Roman citizen. He's not a citizen. And this was just politically impossible, and they had to refuse. And when Attila gets the refusal, this is tantamount to an act of war. And all of a sudden, the Western court is caught in a dilemma because Attila declares war. There's no negotiation on this. And in early 451, Attila levies the barbarian army to end all barbarian armies. He summons all of the Hun tribes across the steppes, his Germanic allies. Roman sources speak of as many as 700,000 people on the move. Probably an exaggeration. Some say the army is more like 50,000, 100,000. How much infantry there is, we don't know. Many German tribes joined along the way. They really had no choice but to join. It clearly included large numbers of mounted horsemen. And these forces swept over the Rhine, there was no barrier, and began to sack the cities of Western Europe, of Gaul, as thoroughly as they had sacked the cities of the Balkans. Many late Roman cities, known today by their modern names, Strasbourg, Worms, Mainz, Cologne, Trier, Metz, Rennes, Tournai, Cambrai, Amiens, Beauvais, fell to the Hun armies. One of the few major cities not to fall was Paris, Latin Lutetia, and that was because the local saint, Genevieve, appeared miraculously and had warned off the Hun hordes. But otherwise, the Huns did a job on eastern and central France, sweeping across, destroying cities, deporting populations, and doing a thorough job of destruction, which ultimately destroyed the very military basis of the Western Roman state by that invasion. Aetius had no choice but to seek allies among the Visigoths and other Germans settled within the Roman Empire. And those included Franks, a detachment of Alans and lesser tribes, and he put together a coalition army of Romans and largely German federate allies, primarily Visigoths, to oppose this great Hun invasion. And his army moved and forced Attila to raise the siege of Orléans. And Attila began to withdraw east. He withdrew east in the general direction of what today is the city of Châlons. And we're not exactly sure where the battle is fought. It's called the Battle of the Catalonian Plains. And that could be anywhere on the plains between Châlons and today Troyes, probably closer to Châlons than Troyes. We know that the Hun and Roman flanks rested on the Marne River. So somewhere in that vicinity, a great battle was fought on an afternoon in the summer of 451. The Hun army was enormous. And Attila drew up his army in three forces. He placed his best forces, the Huns, in the center, his nomadic cavalry with the intention of breaking through the Roman army with typical tactics, And then he deployed his various allied forces on the flanks. These included Ostrogoths, Alans, various Germanic peoples like Burgundians, all sorts of other subject peoples. In the case of Aetius, he weakened his center. He put in his center his weakest forces to receive the Hun attack. And then he stationed his more powerful forces, that is, his Visigoths, who actually opposed their kinsmen, the Ostrogoths, on the other side of the Hun army. And then the Romans and Franks took up the other Roman flank. That was the left. So the Visigoths were on the Roman right, and the Franks and the Romans were on the Roman left with the weak center. The Ostrogoths were opposed to their kinsmen on the Hun side, and then the Romans and Franks faced various Hun allies. Well, the battle opened with a charge of the Hun cavalry that drove deep into the Roman center and scattered it. And it looked like the Roman army was going to be broken in half. The two Gothic forces clashed in a violent attack. Ostrogoths and Visigoths, essentially the same people, went at it. And the Romans and the Franks plowed in to the exposed flank of Attila and eventually forced Attila to quit the battlefield. And it ended in a draw. Later sources said the battle was so fierce that the warriors continued to fight in the sky. And Attila withdrew east, making a beeline back to his capital and vowing to return the next year. And he did. In 452, he invaded northern Italy with another huge barbarian army. He penetrated to the Po Valley, and it looked like the way to Rome was open. There were no imperial forces opposing him because all those German federates would fight for Gaul. They had no interest in Italy, and Aetius was powerless. It is there that Pope Leo I met him and convinced Attila to withdraw for reasons that are still obscure, but it bolstered the reputation of the Pope in Western Europe. And Attila pulled back to his capital somewhere in the area of Budapest and celebrated a great marriage festival. He had married a new German girl. Ildiko is her name. He drank to excess, and in the night, a blood vessel burst, and he drowned in his own blood. The girl was killed, thinking she had murdered him, and she would live on in Norse legend as the Gudrim, or the Krimhild of epic, that is, the dramatic princess who avenged the deaths of her her relatives at the hands of Attila. Now, Attila's death saw the fragmentation of his empire. The subject tribes were raised in rebellion. Compliments of money paid by the new Eastern Roman Emperor Martian, a tough soldier emperor who came to the throne in 450 and had actually supported the Western government in his struggle against Attila. And the empire quickly fragmented. And Attila's sons ruled some Hun tribes on the Pontic Caspian steppes, but they were never again the force they ever were. The career of Attila the Hun essentially shattered the power of the Western Empire. The real victors at Chalons in the invasion of northern Italy were not Attila, but the Germanic tribes who were left to partition what was left of the Roman Empire into independent kingdoms. Meanwhile, the Eastern court had learned its lesson well. Trust to the Theodosian walls and make sure that no future Attila ever emerges on those steps. And the empress, soon to be known as Byzantine Empress, invented Byzantine diplomacy to prevent the revival of another steppe conqueror like Attila the Hun.
Lecture 13, Sassanid Shahs and the Hephthalites.
In this lecture, I plan to cover two new nomadic peoples known as the Hephthalites, or White Huns, and the Gurk Turks, actually ancestors of many of the Turkish peoples today living in the Middle East and Central Asia. And in the last two lectures, we dealt with the Huns, who probably were a proto-Turkish speaking nomadic people, who in some ways represent the climax and conclusion to the nomadic steppe peoples of antiquity on that western steppes. What I want to do in this lecture is turn to the central steppes, the regions that essentially are around the Caspian and Aral Sea and Transoxiana, We discussed them earlier in conjunction with the Kushans and the Sakai and the Parthians. I want to return to that central steppe region and deal with events going on there at the same time the Huns are assaulting the Roman Empire. This means we first must look at the Sassanid Empire, which is the contemporary empire and rival to the late Roman world. And we talked about the Sassanids very briefly in the conclusion on the Parthians, because the Sassanid Shahs, Ardashir I and his son Shapur I, restored the great bureaucratic Persian Empire, known as the Sassanid or Neo-Persian Empire, that saw itself as the direct successor of that Achaemenid Empire of the 5th through the 4th centuries BC. They had overthrown the Parthian rulers, the Arsacid kings, who were seen as interlopers from the steppes, and they founded an effective bureaucratic state. There is still a considerable debate among scholars as to how centralized was this state, but clearly the Sassanid state was far more powerful, wealthy, and better organized than the Parthian kingdom ever was, or probably even the Saka rulers in India or the Kushan emperors. Furthermore, these new Persian emperors were extremely important because they wanted to restore that Persian empire in its fullest extent. And that would have some major consequences, not only for Rome, but for the nomadic peoples dwelling on the central Eurasian steppes. Well, first, let's give us some idea of what this monarchy is all about, what its aspirations are, and then we can look at how these Neo-Persian Shahs, and the word Shah is legitimately used, this is how they would style themselves in their in public inscriptions, on their coins, and in their official documents, how these Shahs came into conflict with Rome and the nomadic peoples. First, they saw themselves as the vice-regents of a new Zoroastrian state. This Zoroastrianism was a monotheism. It emerged out of religious reforms, apparently in the 3rd century AD, taken in tandem by a great thinker known as Khatir, who is now known from inscriptions and religious monuments that were set up in Persia, as well as the Shahs themselves. And this Zoroastrian faith, which centered now on a supreme god, Ahura Mazda, who represents the god of lightness and good and truth, can be traced back clearly on coins not only of the Sassanid kings, but their predecessors, kings who were vassals of the Parthians going back at least to the 2nd century BC. The ancient fire altar became the eternal flame and symbol of Ahura Mazda. And fire altars were set up across the Sassanid Empire as symbols to the power of Ahura Mazda. Animal sacrifice, which had been characteristic of the Persians in earlier times, and we do think that those early Persian kings of the 6th century BC were probably polytheists. They were not strict Zoroastrians. Animal sacrifice was ended. There was a much more devotional worship. The monarchy was closely tied to the veneration of Ahura Mazda. On some of the Sassanid coins, silver coins, the fire altar appears flanked by two guardians. Sometimes they look like royal figures. Sometimes they look like military attendants. They do not look like magi or priests, as far as I can tell, on the numerous coins I've seen. And in some instances, within the flames of the fire altar is apparently Ahura Mazda conceived in human form. And in one case, on a very rare coin of Vaharim V, it may well even be the portrait of the king. So there's a close association between the king and Ahura Mazda. The king is not divine, but he is his vice-regent. And he is locked in eternal battle, both the king and Ahura Mazda, with the forces of evil, with the counter-god, Aharim, the evil one. And this is a struggle that is also reflected in human affairs between the Shah and his political rivals, such as the Roman emperor, or later, the kings of the Hephthalites, and the Khans of the or the Kaans of the various Turkish tribes. Persian coins make that very clearly. Persian coins carry on the obverse the head of the Shah in a magnificent special crown. Around are often concentric circles with symbols of power of earth and the heavens. and the crown pierces it. And the symbolism of the coin is the Shah is in the middle of the earth, and he is designated by Ahura Mazda himself to rule justly over a world empire. And these visions are repeated on coins and on a Sassanid iconography. And they're part of the reason for the success of the Sassanid state. In addition, the Sassanid state is much better organized. In its tax collection, it can support a far more professional army than the Parthians. It's not just tribal levies and nomadic allies from the steppes. They have a siege train. They have logistics. They can capture and rule cities in the way that the Parthians never could. And so they pose a danger to Roman emperors that is considerable. Unlike the Parthians, whom the Romans could always have the better end of any battle or war with them, the Sassanids proved a far tougher opponent. We need not get into the details of the wars between the Romans and the Sassanid Shahs. That belongs more properly to a history of Roman and Sassanid foreign policy. On the other hand, there is a couple of important points to note. In the 3rd century AD, starting with the first Shah, Ardashir I, down to the Shah Narses, who signs a very, very important treaty with the Romans either in 299 or 300 AD, Roman and Sassanid armies clash for control of Armenia and Mesopotamia. They wage repeated and destructive wars. In the end, the Romans win this round of fighting. But it's not until after suffering some very, very humiliating defeats, particularly in the reign of Shapur I. One Roman emperor, Gordian III, who waged a war against Shapur, was apparently lynched by his soldiers in a mutiny engineered by his Praetorian prefect. He's shown on Shapur's victory reliefs as a defeated and slain emperor being trampled. The successor of Gordian III, Philip I, known often as Philip the Arab, in 244, is shown as a suppliant, supplicating Shapur on his relief, and signed a disgraceful treaty promising a subsidy of 10,000 gold pieces to the Shah. These events occurred in 243-244. In 260 AD, Shapur defeated the Emperor Valerian. He lured him into a conference, captured the Roman emperor, who became a captive. He, too, is shown on the reliefs in a subordinate position to the Shah. And these victories exalted the power of the Sassanid Shah over Rome because the Shah demanded the eastern half of the Roman Empire as part of his legacy. However, the Romans regrouped, counterattacked, and by 300 AD, the Shah is signing a treaty relinquishing provinces to the Roman emperor. That situation obtained for about 60 years. And then a new war erupted, which ended in an inglorious defeat by the Roman emperor Julian, who was killed in 363 in an attempt to defeat the then ruling Shah, Shapur II, an ancestor of the first Shapur, and he ruled from 309 to 379, and the result was a series of treaties in 364 in which the Shah now had the better position in the Middle East. In 364, the Romans surrender many of the fortresses of Mesopotamia. In a treaty either in 379 or 382, the Persians take control of the region of Armenia, which is very, very strategic. They think they have the advantage over the Romans. And then the Persians discover to their surprise that the door price for these victorious wars over the Romans is